Good afternoon. Allow me to welcome you to the John R. and Donna S. Hall Engineering Lecture Series. The series was established to bring outstanding engineers to Vanderbilt for the benefit of our students and our community. The series was also established to honor John and Donna Hall. The Halls are civic leaders with a commitment to higher education and the arts. John, a 1955 chemical engineering graduate and retired chairman and CEO of Ashland, Inc., is currently a member of the Vanderbilt Board of Trusts. His wife, Donna, is a member of the Presidential Advisory Committee for the Kennedy Center. And as you might guess, the Halls both have many, many other commitments. We're very proud to have John with us today, and please help me welcome. Now, let me introduce Tom Harris, chairman of our biomedical engineering department, who will introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Dean. Welcome to this afternoon's talk. It's a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Robert Langer to you. Dr. Langer is an institute professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He holds a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering and a PhD in chemical engineering with a bachelor's from Cornell and a PhD from MIT. He is one of the world's leading biomedical and chemical engineers. He has received over 130 awards for his work in this area. He is an expert in the use of polymers for pharmaceutical delivery and in tissue engineering. His work received, it was recognized with the Charles Stark Draper Award of the National Academy of Engineering in 2002. He holds over 500 patents and has published over 800 papers in these fields. He's a member of the National Academy of Engineering, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and a member of the Institute of Medicine. At the time, he was the youngest person ever elected to those bodies, the top honorary bodies in our fields. Among other things, he's an ardent sports fan, and in recent years, in fact, some of that has been rewarded with a little success from the Boston Red Sox, of which he's a longstanding fan. But it's a little unclear about whether the Patriots are going to live up to that this year or not. So it's a great pleasure to introduce Bob.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I probably won't say anything about the Tennessee Titans either. but at any rate, it really is a great honor for me to be here and to give the Hall lectureship. What I wanted to do this afternoon is tell you about the work we've been doing in materials as applied to medicine and engineering. And what I'm going to focus on are two areas. Mostly, I'm going to go over how one might create materials to deliver drugs better. And then I'm also going to, at the end, go over how one might actually combine materials and cells to create new tissues in the human body. So by way of introduction, I want to tell you a little bit about drug delivery. You know, one of the things that's been interesting for me as a professor, and I'm sure and there are many professors here, is that one of the nice things professors do is, you know, we travel around the country, around the world, and we give lectures. And as I'm thinking about how to open this, I remember about 6 years ago, I got asked to give one of the named lecture at the University of California at Berkeley. And I got in very late the night before, about 1 or 2 in the morning. The planes were late. And that lecture was very early in the morning, so I was very tired when I started giving it. And I was trying to think, how should I start? And I said, I said to the audience at Berkeley, it was chemists mostly, I said to the audience at Berkeley, I said, well, probably most of you here have taken drugs. they actually laughed even louder. But, and the point I wanted to make on that is that whenever we take drugs, it's interesting, you know, we swallow a pill or take a shot and the drug level starts out low and it rises and then it goes down. So you take it again. And if you think about it, that's probably not an optimal way to take a drug. What you like to do is have the drug start out at whatever level it should, but then go into this desired range and stay there for a prolonged period of time. In fact, when it doesn't, because it gets too high, it can cause really bad side effects. When it's too low, it's not effective. There was an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association a few years ago showing that over 100,000 deaths in the United States every year can be attributed to people taking prescription drugs the way they're supposed to because of these very issues. And one of the things that we started wondering about many years ago was, could we come up with ways to deliver drugs better, to control their level, and as I'll go over in this talk, to even in some cases begin to target them to the very specific site in the human body where you want them to be. And it's this has been an interesting area, both from a healthcare standpoint and an economic standpoint. If you look 25 years ago, none of these systems existed, and obviously there were no sales. But today, last year, just to give you an example, probably nearly 100 million people worldwide use the type of systems I'll be talking about. Sales in the U.S. last year were close to $30 billion. So it's having an enormous impact. Let me just start out and show you some pictures to illustrate what I mean. Here's one of the earliest of the controlled release, it's not going up to the screen, one of the earliest of the controlled release systems, if we can get it on here. Do you want to come back? Anyhow, what I'm going to do is show you a nitroglycerin patch in a second. This would be one of the earliest of the controlled release systems. It'll work fine before.
Yeah, I think it's...
No, it's okay. Do you want the projection?
It's coming on this computer. So that's a problem.
It's what?
It's projecting on this computer as opposed to...
The screen?
Yeah.
Do you want? So anyhow, what I'm going to show you on the first slide, it's a nitroglycerin patch. What you'll see in a second is that you see a man's chest, and there'll be a patch on it. And basically, it delivers nitroglycerin over a 24-hour period. What I would show you on the second slide...
I think that
system, the nitroglycerin patch, that lasts for 24 hours. But controlled drug delivery is a... How are we doing?
It's going to the computer.
There we go.
Okay.
That's the patch that you saw before. And that lasted for 24 hours. And I just want to show you here that this is another system. This is actually a system you may have heard of. It's called the Norplant. And these systems are little matchstick-sized systems that are placed underneath the skin, and they can deliver the drug for over 2,000 days or 5 years from little implants. These are used in over 50 countries around the world. That was approved in the U.S. in 1991. I want to turn back the clock, though, and I'd like to tell you how I got involved in this. I want to turn back the clock to 1974, 31 years ago. And like all of you, I'm an engineer. Like many of you, I'm an engineer. I got my degree in chemical engineering from MIT in 1974, as was mentioned. When I got my degree, there was supposedly like this energy crisis. I know there's like one today as well. But in 1974, for those of you who are old enough, if you wanted to get gas in your car, you actually had, older people like me will remember this, You had to wait in line for 2 hours or 3 hours if you wanted to get gas for your car. It was like long waits. And the concept, so today you got it easy, just high prices. But at any rate, what there were all kinds of jobs in the oil industry. I actually got 4 jobs alone from Exxon. But I wasn't that excited about them. And I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And in the end, I ended up doing something very different. I decided to work in a hospital with a surgeon named Judah Folkman. And the problem that he was trying to solve was, how do blood vessels grow in the body? And could we stop blood vessels from growing? The idea being that if we could do that, maybe that would lead to new drugs that could stop cancer someday. because blood vessels are critical for the tumor to grow. So that was the what we started working on. Now, it was kind of basic research at the time, but what would happen was just 4 years later, the whole advent of biotechnology and genetic engineering emerged. And for the first time, it became possible to make large molecules like peptides and proteins. Yet these molecules were very difficult to swallow, which is the way we take most drugs, to put in a patch. And even if you injected them, what we see is very short lifetimes in the body. So if you wanted to deliver any of these on a chronic basis, it would be critical to have a way to deliver them in an unaltered form and yet protect them from harm. Now, when we started this research, the conventional wisdom in this field was that you could not do this. So if you look in the literature in the 1970s, you often see quotes like this one. I'll read you this. This is 1977, 28 years ago. It says, the agent to be released, it's a direct quote, is a small molecule with a molecular weight no larger than a few hundred. One would not expect that macromolecules, that's what we're trying to do, like proteins, could be released because of their extremely small permeation rates through polymers. Actually, this quote was very helpful to us in getting some of those patents that were mentioned. And people, so actually what I did is I actually spent 2 years in the laboratory doing different experiments to try to see if I could solve this problem. I actually found over 200 different ways to get this to not work. But finally, I discovered one way to get it to work. I found if I could take very hydrophobic polymers, polymers that absorb very little water, like ethylene vinyl acetate copolymer or lactic glycolic acid copolymer, dissolve them in organic solvents, add powdered protein, usually at very low temperatures, like minus 80 degrees to minimize denaturation, and then we could evaporate off the solvent. We could make little microspheres like this. Here's one cut in half. And these systems could release the drug for over 100 days. This is from an early paper we wrote in Nature showing that that was possible. Though, as you notice when you look at the slide, the release rates are not constant. Later on, using some engineering approaches, we worked out ways to get constant release. You know, but one of the things that was interesting to me was how does this work, and I'm going to come back to this a few times in the talk, get received by the scientific community. Well, in 1976, I got asked for the very first time to give a talk at a major scientific meeting. In fact, up until that time, I'd never given a real talk before. Well, actually once in eighth grade. And I didn't do too well in that eighth grade talk. I actually remember the night before I was stood in front of my parents' mirror for 4 hours reciting this minute and a half talk, and then finally the next day I got up in front of my eighth grade class and I kind of recited it. I didn't bring up my sheet of paper, I should have. And after the first minute I could not remember the next word. And I just stood up there and I froze for a minute until a teacher finally told me to sit down and didn't give me a particularly good grade. So this time I decided it would not happen again. I stopped work 2 weeks in advance of that talk, and I kept rehearsing it into a tape recorder. That was before VCRs or anything. And this time I got up and I gave this talk, and again, this was 29 years ago, so I was quite a bit younger. I had a lot more hair and wasn't as gray. And I was lecturing to a very senior audience of, you know, world-famous polymer chemists and engineers. And I got up and I gave that talk, and at the end of the 20 minutes, I actually felt I did all right, because this time I didn't forget anything I was going to say. I didn't stammer too much. So I thought when I was done with this talk that these more elder chemists and engineers, being nice people, I can see some people here have given talks before, I thought they would want to encourage me, this young guy. And when I got done, a whole bunch of them came up to me and they said, we don't believe anything you just said. It was kind of my introduction to how scientists sometimes treat other scientists. I'm going to come back to this point later. But it wasn't then until another 3 years, 1979, that people started to repeat what we did. And then the question shifted to how could this possibly happen? So what we did, this was work done by Rajan Bawa, one of my students, is we cut thin sections through these polymers using a cryomicrotome, low-temperature cutting instrument. And when we did, we could visualize them. It said no drug in it. If you did a permeability study, what you'd find is that molecules 300 molecular weight or greater cannot diffuse from one side of this to the other. How do the molecules get out? What we found is that if we put a red drug in, this is just to visualize it, this is before any release has taken place, cut another thin section, here's what it looks like. The white is the polymer, the red is the protein. Now, if we release this for a year or two and cut a thin section, what we see in sharp contrast to what you saw two slides ago are pores created by the drug particles. And it turns out that these pores are large enough so that molecules, even 2 million molecular weight, can get through. But they also, these pores are interconnected. They have many tight constrictions between them. And they're incredibly winding and tortuous. So it takes a very long time for the molecules to get through. Myself, living in Massachusetts, I always explain this to people as like driving a car through Boston. And I know most of you haven't been there, but if you have, it's a very confusing city to get around. Turns out that what you can do and is we actually have been able to design these systems to release anywhere from a day to actually over 3 years or any time in between. In fact, the biggest single problem that I have found as a professor in getting really long-term release is actually not the design of these systems, but rather my ability to find a graduate student who will do the experiment that long for their thesis. And I was very lucky, actually, in the 1980s, I had a very good graduate student named Mark Saltzman, and he actually did this experiment for over 3 years. It kept coming out and coming out. And finally, one day, Mark said he wanted to talk to me, and I said, sure. And Mark said, Bob, he said, I've been thinking. He said, what will I do if this experiment fails? He said, do I have to repeat it? So we stopped at 3 years and 2 months. On 5 days. But I've always thought with the right student, you know, we could go 6 or 7 years. And it's really actually paid off. Mark actually now is an endowed chair and is chairman of biomedical engineering at Yale University. So it really pays off to do these long-term experiments. Now, as I mentioned to you in the very beginning of the talk, one of our goals was to study angiogenic factors, factors that could induce blood vessels or inhibit them. And we were now able to do that because we could do this. So one of the ways we did this is we actually looked at the eye of a rabbit, which normally has no blood vessels. We put a little polymer in. Take a look. Here's the edge of the cornea. We're going to come back 17 days later. What we see are blood vessels growing from the edge of that right to the polymer. And this now has been used to isolate all kinds of angiogenesis factors, like vascular endothelial cell growth factor, epidermal growth factor, and others. We could also look at them for inhibitors. So here's the eye of a rabbit. Here's a tumor, and here's a polymer. And we can actually look at inhibitors. And we actually isolated the very first inhibitor of angiogenesis in 1976, which we published in Science. We called it a cartilage-derived inhibitor. Here you see, without the inhibitor, the tumor's actually here. You can't see it, but the eye is cloudy because of the tumor. Blood vessels grow like a sheet over it, right to the tumor. But if you put the inhibitor in, look at what happens. The vessels are sparser. Here's the polymer. They actually avoid it. And this has been used to isolate many inhibitors. Just to tell you an interesting story, however, you know, we did this in 1976. It took 28 years from this discovery for the very first drugs to become approved by the FDA, 2004. And what's amazing, and that was Avastin by Genentech, which is actually having an enormous impact on cancer. It may become the largest and most important cancer drug of all time, which stops blood vessels. Not only that, these same principles are now being used for new drugs to treat macular degeneration. The first of those, Macugen, was just approved less than a year ago. The second, Lucentis, which is yet to be approved. The clinical trials are amazing, actually starting to show that you can reverse macular degeneration. But it took 28, 29 years before, from this initial discovery, for that to happen. So we, you know, I'm kind of impatient. I'd like to see impact before that. Medicine is tough, though. And so one of the things that we wanted to do, and that we did do early on, now I'm turning back the clock again, is see if we could get in vivo feasibility. Could we deliver insulin, just as an example? Larry Brown, one of our graduate students, did that. We put little insulin pellets in diabetic rats as a proof of principle, and we're able to get steady release of insulin for 3 months. Now, it turns out insulin, because of the possibility of delivering too much, wasn't something that I was able to convince companies to do very quickly. And in fact, it was hard to get industrial interest. So I got involved in a lot of patent licensing and even starting companies in Cambridge myself. And it took a long time to get these things to be developed. But now there are actually quite a few products based on this technology that people use. Some of them deliver drugs like luteinizing hormone, releasing hormone analogs. These are nanopeptides. And these molecules are very powerful ways of treating advanced prostate cancer. Right now, you can't swallow them, you can't put them in a patch, they're just too big. If you injected them, they were destroyed in seconds. So now they're putting these little microspheres. And originally they released for a month, now they're released for 4 months. This is the most widely used way of treating advanced prostate cancer or endometriosis or precocious puberty. More recently, actually, Alchemies, which is a company we started, worked with Johnson & Johnson. And they, I don't know how many of you have seen this movie, Beautiful Mind, with Russell Crowe? Some of you. A lot of you. So you may know, if you watched it, that you know he had schizophrenia. He kept seeing people. And how did they treat him? They treated him with shock treatment. Now they actually have some very good drugs to treat them. Problem is patient compliance. People don't take them. So what's been done is to take these drugs like Risperdal, which is a decent schizophrenic drug, but people don't take it, so they get hospitalized. But now what they've done is put it in these little microspheres like this, called Risperdal Consta. They give injections once every several weeks. It's totally changed the hospitalization issues and other issues, and it's actually being very, very widely used. So today, if they were making that movie, he wouldn't be doing the shock treatment. He'd be getting this. This was actually just approved a year ago. In fact, I expect next month there'll be another approval from Alchemies that's at the FDA now for treating alcoholism, a once-a-month injection. So there's all kinds of these things that are now being used. But you know, and again, these companies will go on and on. There'll be different products, we hope, for different treatments. But going back to the academic lab, we always think, you know, we'd like to do better. What can we do to do better? And what you might realize is that once you put any of these systems in a person, you can't change what happens. If that person needs more drug, you can't do anything. If you need an increase, you can't do anything. So about 12 years ago, I was watching this television show on PBS. Usually I watch sports, but this time I happened to be watching PBS, so I'm not sure why. And they were talking about how microchips were made in the computer industry. And as I was watching that show, I thought to myself, boy, wouldn't this be a great way to make a drug delivery system? Now, if you spent 30 years of your life doing research on drug delivery systems, maybe any show you watched, you might think that. But as I watched it, I thought to myself, this would be really neat if we could do this. And I called up one of my colleagues, Michael Sima, who's an expert at ceramics processing. He's in the material science department. Said, could we make a little chip? And so here's what we came up with. This is a prototype chip. There's little wells we build into it. It's all microfabrication, all my engineering ideas. This is a cutaway. Here's one. Here you see like little wells, and in these wells we can put different drugs in. And here we're covering with gold. We've got little wires going out. All this can be made like by photolithography, microfabrication kind of techniques. And you could put different drugs or different levels of drug in these wells. So like one model, you might put. In fact, now there's a company. John Santini, our graduate student, started a company to make these chips. So here's the United States dime. Here's an early chip with 34 wells in the top, 34 in the bottom. Now they've got chips that have 400 wells in them. They have chips that are injectable. They have chips that are totally degradable, all kinds of chips. But the idea is that you could put many, many doses of the drug in different wells to be released at different times. You could put many different drugs on the chip. You could literally have a pharmacy on a chip, all the drugs you'd need to take. This is our future vision. So how do they work? Well, let's take a look at a well. It's covered with gold. But what we're going to do is apply 1 volt selectively in the presence of a small amount of chloride ion. And let's take a look at this well in a 10-second time period. The gold comes off, and as it does, whatever's underneath it comes right out. In fact, Jim Anderson, one of the top pathologists in the world at Case Western, has been collaborating with us, and he's found that even if you take 16,000 times that amount of gold, it causes no harm to animals. So we believe it will be safe. So here's some of what's been done. This is work by John Santini, where he's triggered release of different amounts of drug in different wells in a day and a half, 2.5, 4.5, 5.5 days. This next slide is more like the pharmacy on the chip idea, where he's triggered release of one drug at 25 hours, another at 37 hours, this same drug from a different well at 50 hours, and this same drug from a different well at 60 hours. They've now done studies at microchips where they've actually triggered release in animals 100 straight times over 6 months, and it's quite reproducible and quite safe. So in the long run, how do we envision that we might use these? Well, maybe we'd have an implant or a patch or a pill, and you could control release by telemetry. Same way you open up garage doors, you could open up any of these wells. like you might use radio frequency, and maybe it's something that you have in a wristwatch or, you know, BlackBerry or, you know, something that you could just have, and it could be programmed and to have the release whenever you want. Or in the further future, what we envision, maybe we could put little biosensors on these chips, along with microprocessors and power sources, so we can actually detect signals in the human body and tell the chip how much to deliver in response to those signals. Also, since it's a chip, one of the other things that I've found as I've gotten older is, you know, I keep forgetting when I took my last drug, and it's worse and worse as I get older. And now since it's, and medical record keeping is actually a big problem, hospitals everywhere. So now since it's a chip, whenever you take the drug, that information could be transmitted from the chip to your computer. At your house, doctor's office, or hospital, so you can have a permanent record of whatever you did. Okay, so far what I've done is I've told you how we might engineer drug delivery systems using the existing materials, using engineering approaches. But another thing that I began to find as I worked at the hospitals in the 1970s, I started to wonder, how do materials find their way into medicine? Is it because of chemists or engineers or material scientists? Turns out that it's not. Almost always what I found as I looked into this was that the way materials found their way into medicine was medical doctors. And medical doctors urgently wanted to solve a medical problem. And what they would do is they would go to their house and they would find an object that kind of resembled the organ or tissue they wanted to fix, that kind of resembled the one in the human body, and then they'd use the same material to fix the person. And while that enabled some progress, it also created some problems. Let me give you some examples. And I realize when people look at this list, they may actually think it's funny. But actually, it's true, and I could make the list longer. Here's the artificial heart. In 1967, at the National Institutes of Health, some of the clinicians wanted to make an artificial heart. And they said, well, what object is kind of like a heart, has a good flex life? They said, well, a lady's girdle. They said, what's it made out of? They said, it's made out of a polyether urethane. So they made the artificial heart out of that same material. Now we're 38 years later. What's happened with the artificial heart? Well, what's happened is, and people may have seen this in various newspapers, what's happened is see, people are still using ladies' girdle material. Because once you start down that path from a regulatory standpoint, it's not so easy to change. And what's happened is blood sometimes hits the surface of the artificial heart. It forms a clot. And that clot could go to the patient's brain, and they could get a stroke, and they may die. And yet, if you think about it, something that was designed to be a lady's girdle, you know, it may not be the optimal blood contacting material. And this problem pervades all of medicine. Dialysis tubing with sausage casing, vascular graft, that's an artificial blood vessel. It was a surgeon in Texas going to a clothes store to see what he could sew well with. And breast implants. One was a lubricant, the other actually a mattress stuffing. You can probably think of the logic. But they used. Now, we decided to take a very different approach, what I'll call an engineering design approach. We decided that rather than take these materials that already existed, what if we ask the question, what do we really want in a biomedical material from an engineering standpoint, from a chemistry standpoint, from a biology standpoint, and then could we synthesize them? So we picked an example. When we started, the only set of materials that was approved by the FDA were for implants, synthetic polymers, dissolved like this, bulk erosion, starting out like this, then they get spongy, and then they fall apart. Now, normally you distribute the drug uniformly in them, but if that happens, you get bursts of drug coming out. That could be fatal, say, for an anti-cancer drug or insulin. So we said from an engineering standpoint, you wouldn't want to do that. What you'd want to do, we believe, is this, surface erosion. That would avoid the chances of the drug dumping out. How do you get this? So we went through a very detailed engineering design. Said, well, do we want enzymes to cause the erosion or do we want water to cause the erosion? What do you think? Well, everybody in this room has different enzyme levels. Also, the cellular response around an implant changes over time. So that wouldn't be very reproducible. We said, however, everyone has excess water. Let's make the catalyst to make this polymer dissolve be water. And again, we can do this if we're starting from scratch. We can do whatever we want. And then we said, well, if we do that, how do we get the right degradation? We had to figure out what are called the right monomers. We had to figure out the right bonds. We had to make sure that the monomers were safe. So we actually got a lot of people involved in this, to help predict, even toxicologists. Like Mike Marletta, now head of chemistry at Berkeley, was one of my colleagues and helped predict some of the chemistry for us about what would be safe and what wouldn't be. And in the end, we came up with this polymer. It's a polyanhydride with two monomers. this is one of them, this is the other. What was interesting is after we were able to synthesize them, by changing the, not only would they show the surface erosion, but by changing the ratio of this to this, we could make these polymers last almost any length of time. And here is an example of that, percent degraded versus time with 0% of basic acid, 8% dissolved in 14 weeks. It'll take 3 or 4 years for a millimeter thick slab to fully dissolve. But if you add a little bit more of basic acid, it dissolves faster. This is all gone in 2 weeks. So you could simply dial in the ratio of these monomers and ideally get whatever erosion rate you want. So because we could do this, we could begin thinking about some new medical applications. And in the mid-1980s, a young neurosurgeon named Henry Brown, who was just starting at Johns Hopkins, came to see me, along with Michael Colvin, who was one of his colleagues. And they were wondering, could we come up with better ways to help them treat brain cancer? Brain cancer, as you may know, is a terrible disease. This is the most common form. It's uniformly fatal, regardless of how you treat the patient, mean lifespans less than a year. The drugs that they give, like BCNU, the most common one, are terribly toxic. They're normally given intravenously, systemically. They travel throughout the entire body, cause very serious side effects to the liver, kidney, and spleen. But Henry and I had an idea. Since we developed these new polymers, maybe we could introduce a new paradigm, local chemotherapy. Could we take high concentrations of these drugs, and rather than give them IV, could we just give them right at the site? So what we proposed, and let me translate this now to brain tumors, were, could the neurosurgeon like Dr. Brown operate on the patient, but before he closes the patient, could he line the surgical cavity with these little polymers? Normally, the drug's got a 12-minute lifetime, but if you put it in the polymer, it'll be protected from degradation, and it will last as long as the polymers last. The neurosurgeons wanted a polymer that was degradable so it wouldn't accumulate in the brain, that had the surface degrading property so it wouldn't dump the drug. And from animal studies, they wanted it to last for a month. All that could be done with the polymer chemistry we have. And the bottom point is probably the most important. High concentrations in the brain where you want it to be, and low concentrations in the rest of the body where it causes harm. Now the thing is, and I mentioned this before in a different way, whenever you come up with a new idea, new polymers, local chemotherapy, what you have to do as a professor, and every professor here has the same experience I probably did, is you have to raise money for it. And the way we raise money for it, if you're in the health-related areas, you write a grant proposal, and they go to the National Institutes of Health, for example, or NSF, and then your peers, professors at other universities, they review them, and they decide whether they like it or not. Now, this idea didn't do very well. I actually saved the grant reviews. This is not comprehensive either. But I entitled this slide, "This Approach Will Not Work Because." When we first proposed it, the reviewer said, "You can't synthesize the polymers." But I had a very good graduate student at the time named Howie Rosen. Howie eventually became president of the ALZA Corporation, a $20 billion part of Johnson & Johnson. Today, the most successful drug delivery company. Howie got elected to the National Academy of Engineering a few years ago. And he worked out a way to synthesize it. So we sent the grant back. The NIH isn't real fast. It takes a while. But sent the grant back, and they said, "Well, that's good, but you know, these are using anhydrides. They're very reactive. They'll react with whatever drugs you put in." So I had another couple of postdocs. Bob Linhart, who's now Constellation Professor at RPI, and Cam Leung just got a chair at Duke and bioengineering, and they worked out ways to make sure that wouldn't happen. Sent it back again. Reviewer said, "Well, still shouldn't fund it. You know, these polymers are fragile. They're low molecular weight. They'll break in the body." Had another couple of postdocs. Edith Mathiewicz, who's a full professor of bioengineering at Brown today, and Avi Dohm, who's chairman of medicinal chemistry at Hebrew University, and they worked out ways to using the right catalysts and time and temperature conditions to make sure the polymers were really strong and they wouldn't break. Sent it back again. And they said, "Well, still wouldn't work because these are brand new materials that certainly will not be safe." Had another graduate student, Cato Lorenzen. Cato got elected to the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences a year ago. And Cato is now university professor and chairman of orthopedic surgery at the University of Virginia. And Cato proved, in fact, they were quite safe. Anyhow, this kept going on and on until 1996, when the FDA approved it for treating brain cancer. In fact, it was the first time in over 20 years they approved a new treatment for brain cancer, the first time they ever approved this concept of polymer-based local chemotherapy. One of the things you can probably tell from the way I'm talking is that I'm very proud of how well our graduate students and postdocs have done. They have become chairmen of major corporations, heads of major departments, have endowed chairs. The reviewers, they haven't done so well. Now let me show you. I always like to think there's justice in the world. Let me actually show you. I'd like to actually show you what the operation looks like. And if anybody's squeamish, I'm serious about this, and doesn't like the sight of blood, you shouldn't look. But I'm going to show you human brains. And they're little wafers going into the human brain. Usually they put 7 or 8 in and close the patient up. You know, it's always hard to get good advice when you give a talk. But about 7 years ago, I was giving a talk at MIT to a group of engineers, and my wife came to the talk, and you know, she'll tell me what she thinks. So I asked her, I said at the end of the talk, I said, well, Laura, what did you think of the talk? And she said, well, Bob, the talk was all right. That's actually very high praise. But she said, you know, you had those two bloody slides on for about 10 minutes. She said, I don't know if you were looking, but all those poor engineers, they were turning green and looking at the floor. So ever after that, I did what I've done today. I've showed them very quickly. But I do want to tell you the sequel to that was that about 2 years after that, I actually got asked to give this dinner speech. But this was actually to a group of neurosurgeons. And I told them that same story. And at the end of it, a bunch of the neurosurgeons came up to me after the talk and they said, you know those two bloody slides you showed after dinner? I said, yes. They said, those were fine. They said, you could have left those on as long as you want. No problem. They said, but those chemical formulas. You know, to leave those on for a neurosurgeon, you know, I guess you just don't do that. So let me just show you a little bit of the clinical data. This is at the end of the year in the what's called phase 3 trials, final trial before FDA approval. You get 63% survival in the treated group and 19% in the control. At the end of 2 years, 31% in the treated group, 6% in the control. And what's interesting is not only is this now being used for brain tumors, it's being used for some other kind of tumors, but really where it's made the greatest impact, it turns out, is in interventional cardiology. The very same principle is now used in for cardiovascular stents. So if somebody has heart disease now, one of the things that's very common, a way of treating them, is to put these little things in, stents. They're like Chinese finger puzzles. They keep the blood vessels open. Problem is about 40% of the time they close off because of cellular proliferation. So now what they've done, same exact idea, they take toxic anti-cancer drugs like Taxol, put them in a polymer coating just like I showed you. Now on the stent, they locally deliver the drugs. Totally changes this problem of restenosis. Instead of 40% of the time people getting that, now they get it about 4% of the time. Sales of this has been unbelievable. They were first approved in 2003. Last year the sales were about $5 billion. I mean, and they keep going up. It's having an enormous medical and health impact. Well, so far, though, everything I've talked to you about has been what I'll call invasive. You know, we've gotten injections, implants. Could we ever do anything non-invasively? So I'd actually like to tell you what I think is a very nice engineering story. About 12 years ago, I got visited by a young man named David Edwards. And David is what I call a real chemical engineer. He'd written about 30 papers on modeling. He'd modeled everything. He was a really expert at math. He'd written 2 books also on modeling. And in fact, he came to our lab, which as you can see is a pretty experimental lab. David actually at this point had never done an experiment in his life, but he did a lot of modeling. And so he came to our lab, and the very first thing he started working on was transdermal delivery. And I remember after a couple months he handed me this paper on transdermal delivery with 300 equations in it, describing every aspect of it. And actually I always felt my big contribution was reducing it to about 250 equations. And the paper actually even won an award. I don't know about for the equations, but at any rate, then I said to him, you know, I said, maybe I have an idea for you. I said, you know, there's this area. He'd actually done some modeling of a lung. And so, you know, one of the things I noticed doing drug delivery was a lot of companies were trying to deliver aerosols better. And thing is, aerosol delivery is unbelievably ineffective. I don't know how many people here, people have taken them for asthma or things like that. But it's a really interesting thing. You're lucky. You're lucky if you get 3% of the drug from your aerosol device into the lung. Now, not only is that an issue of cost, that's actually the smallest part. It's more an issue of inefficiency. If you only get 3% in, you know, there's a lot of drugs like insulin and others that if you ever wanted to use that way, you'd need a giant canister. You can't put it in your pocket, obviously. So what did companies do? Well, actually, they started using mechanical engineering principles. They started to, what they realized is the reason the aerosols didn't work very well, why they get so little, is everybody always thought that the aerosols had to be very tiny, like 2 or 3 microns in diameter. And if they were bigger, people always felt they'd stick in the back of your throat. But when they're 2 or 3 microns, the problem is they aggregate. They stick in the aerosolizer, stick in the air, stick in your mouth, stick everywhere. So by the time they get to where you want them to be, you don't have very many. So what people did is they developed better and better aerosolizers with more power to break them apart. And they might go from 2 or 3% to 3 to 4%, which is actually a big deal, right? You could make your aerosolizer 50% smaller. But still, they lost almost all of it. What David started thinking about was nobody's ever looked at the aerosol itself. When we started, every aerosol that had ever been used, most of them were like in what are called nebulizers or metered dose inhalers. They're water. They have a density of 1 gram per cc. People actually have done a little bit of work on what are called dry powder inhalers. They also had a density of 1 gram per cc, like water. But what David started wondering is, what if he made these aerosols really big, but really light, very porous? What would happen then? And he modeled this. And it turns out that what's called their aerodynamic diameter is the same. And if he makes these aerosols like this, they will still flow, even though they're much bigger than normal, they will not settle in the back of the throat. They'll go to the deep lung. But what we started thinking about is now if we made them big, they shouldn't aggregate the same way. This is going to aggregate like wet sand, right? There's so much surface area. These much bigger ones, now say 10 microns, aren't going to aggregate so much. I mean, think about comparing wet basketballs. Wet basketballs are not going to aggregate like wet sand. So they're much easier aerosolized. Also, the other thing is when you made a tiny aerosol, they never last very long. As soon as they get into the lung, there are cells called macrophages. They eat them. It's like eating a small meal. But we started thinking, now if we make these big aerosols, they're going to take longer to eat. It's like eating a big meal. So could we do this? Could we make them? Well, Jeff Herkash, Giovanni Caponetti, and Justin Haynes in our laboratory, and Noah Lotan worked out a way to do it. And here are some pictures of these by SEM. And let me just give you a simple sports analogy. Up till we got involved, all the aerosols, if you looked at them under a microscope, looked like little golf balls or little baseballs, density of 1 gram per cc. All we're doing is making big wiffle balls. No different. It's all just that simple. So here's what they look like, wiffle balls. But that simple change has a huge effect on what you get. So here's what an in vitro experiment, an Anderson impactor. This is a respirable fraction. Normally, about 6 8%. Now it's close to 60% with the porous ones. If you go to an animal experiment, the different lobes of the lung, we see the porous ones are about 10 times higher than non-porous. If you go to animal experiments, this is insulin, which is now in very advanced clinical trials. Probably will be approved by the FDA soon, is what you can see is here's small, non-porous or untreated. Here's injected, the blue. Here's inhaled, the purple. And they're almost the same, 86% of the area under the curve. Also, this particular one, because we made it big, lasted for 4 days with a single whiff. So one of the things that David did is he actually wanted to start a company on this, which we did. Called Advanced Inhalation Research. We took a whole bunch of these into the clinic, and as I mentioned, it's now in advanced clinical trials for insulin, human growth hormone, epinephrine, like if somebody gets a bee sting, right now you can take a shot, this will change that, many others. Company was probably one of the most, maybe the most successful biotech company in the Boston area. The investors that put money in it realized something like a 2,000% IRR, that's a 2,000% annualized return. And David actually did very well. He actually, with some of the money, purchased a building across from the Boston Public Library, creating the Cloud Foundation for underprivileged children. He was the youngest person ever to get elected to the National Academy of Engineering for this work. So it's actually a very nice way of using engineering principles to solve this kind of problem, which is really changing aerosol science. Now, the last thing I want to spend maybe about 10, 15 minutes on today is not only could we use maybe biomedical engineering principles to deliver drugs, but what about to deliver cells? There's so many diseases that there's no good way to treat patients. There's no drugs. And let me just share you an example with you. This is a patient of Jay Vacanti's. Jay is a surgeon I work very closely with. Jay's had a pediatric surgery at Mass General Hospital. So here's a little boy who's dying of liver failure. And the only way a child like that can live is somebody else has to die. That is the only treatment today, is a transplant. But because of that, Jay and I started thinking about maybe we could come up with other strategies. What if we could do the following? Take cells from the patient themselves, or a close relative, this is bone, cartilage, liver, intestine, urothelial cell, grow them on the appropriate polymer, grow them actually, and I'll go over this more in a second, outside the body, and then when you could actually make a tissue, you could actually put it inside the body. There's a lot of engineering in here, both in terms of the design of the exact chemistry of the polymer and its three-dimensional structure, because you have to make it in such a way that the cells can communicate and reorganize to make a tissue. Let me just show you a scanning electron micrograph of this. Here's a high-powered micrograph of the polymer fibers, in this case with liver cells. But let me just speculate with you about where this field may eventually go. Let's say 20 or 30 years from now, I'll just pick an example, plastic surgery. Somebody comes in and they want a new nose. In fact, what I'm going to talk about was pioneered by Professor Shastri when he was with us and is now at the Smithsonian Institute. But let's say somebody wanted a new nose. I think what you'll be able to do in 20 or 30 years is you could go to a computer screen and pick out whatever kind of nose you want. It could be a regular nose like this, or maybe somebody would like an upturned nose. So that's easy. This is a polymer. We just take a little bit off. In fact, what you'll be able to use is use CAD-CAM techniques, computer-aided design techniques, to exactly design whatever nose you want. Now, maybe somebody would want a hook nose. Probably they wouldn't, but if they did, you just add a little more polymer. And you could then take the fact Prasad did all this, you could take cells from the patient or an animal, put it on the nose, and you know, literally make a nose. This actually has been, Alan Alda looked at this, all kinds of people have looked at this nose. We actually have a very nice shot in Boston of Prasad handing it to Alan Alda, who was very excited about the nose. I don't mean to embarrass him too much. But at any rate, but it's just an example of how one could use computer-aided design engineering approaches to do this. Now, I'm going to digress for just a second. You might think as you're looking at this nose, does that mean that you're going to have to do an operation, you know, make a big incision to put the nose in? And as I started thinking about this, it occurred to me, you know, maybe there's something we can do for tissue engineering even more broadly, using what I'll call minimally invasive surgery. You know, could we figure out how to get bulky objects into the body in a simpler way? You know, so right now, instead of making these big incisions, which they do all the time to put objects in, what if we made a tiny incision, like just a little hole? And you may know that minimally invasive surgery, they do that now to take things out of the body, right? You take a gallbladder out, you make a tiny incision, you put medical instruments in, you can yank it out, you can see the whole thing on a TV screen. I started wondering, what if we could put things in through those holes? How could you do it? Could we put a bulky object in through those holes? So the idea that I started thinking about is, what if we could make a series of biocompatible shape memory polymers? Polymers that at room temperature would be like a string, so they could go through that hole, but when they got to body temperature, they convert to whatever shape we want, like a sheet to prevent adhesions, a stent which would be like a coil, or whatever else we'd want. So how could we do that? Well, what we did, I had another very good postdoc, Andreas Lenline, and what we did is we made a series of what we call phase-segregated multi-block copolymers. The idea is that one phase would control the shape at room temperature, and the other would control the shape at body temperature, which is higher. And the idea, the way we would do this, is we would create a series of crosslinks. And the idea is that the one that controlled the shape at room temperature would comprise those crosslinks, but it would melt, say, at 30 degrees C. in between room temperature and body temperature. We also, by the way, recently published in Nature a way to do this with light, where we could change cross-linking by light. But at any rate, let's just take the temperature one, so that we could do this by temperature. So at room temperature would be like a string, but at body temperature, if you rise above that temperature, it would convert to the second phase, whatever shape we decided to put that phase in. So let me just illustrate that. I'm going to show you a video where we're going to start with a string, but hopefully when it goes into water, which is body temperature, it converts to a coil. So here's the string, here's the water. And we're going to drop this string into the water at 37 degrees, I hope. Okay, here it goes. Here's the string. Now the water is body temperature. That's the shade memory effect. This is real time. Let me give you a second example. Again, let's say you had a surgical wound that you wanted to tie a surgical knot in. If it was in your arm or you could actually tie that knot, I could probably even do it. You probably wouldn't want me to do it, but I could do it. But what about inside the body? Let's say you have a wound in your lung or your stomach. How could you ever tie the knot there? Well, we thought, what if we made the knots tie themselves? What if we looped in a loose knot, like a lasso, a room temperature, but then when it gets to the body temperature, it just tightens? So let me give you another illustration of that. So here's the loose knot at room temperature. Here's the water at 37 degrees. And we're going to drop this loose knot into the water. And hopefully it'll tighten. Again, showing you the shape memory effect. Well, again, with this as a little bit of polymer background, let me take you through four tissues. First, blood vessels. You may know that Bill Clinton had open heart surgery. And right now, the way they treat people with open heart surgery is they actually have to take blood vessels from their leg and put them into the heart. For Bill Clinton, who's a pretty young, healthy guy, it's not so bad. For some people, it's a really serious problem. So one of the questions that Laura Nicholson in our lab at the time wanted to look at is, could we make a new blood vessel? So David, and this was a really multidisciplinary project. David Mooney, who was one of our graduate students, now in the faculty of Harvard, made these little tiny 3 millimeter diameter tubes, 97% porous. Jinming Gao, another postdoc, now a professor at Texas Southwestern, modified the polyglycolic acid tubes chemically to get a high attachment density of smooth muscle cells. Laura Nicholson, then, her idea was to make them look like a blood vessel, to put the smooth muscle cells on, and then endothelial cells. Those are the two key cell types. But I don't know how many of you have grown cells in the lab or watched people grow cells, but normally when people grow cells, they kind of sit there in 96-well plates or shake flaps. And what Laura started thinking about as we tried a lot of things and none of them worked was that that's not what happens in our body. In our body, our blood vessels are hooked up to a pulsatile pump, our heart. And so she wondered, maybe she could create a series of bioreactors to mimic what our body does to create pulsatile radial stress. And so here's what she did. She figured out the right medium, made a pulsatile pump beating at 165 beats per minute, pulsing all this in over time, over an 8-week period. And when she was done, here's what you get these little vessels. If you characterize them, they're 50% collagen, their rupture strengths are greater than 2,000 millimeters of mercury. You can suture them in, and they have the same pharmacology as a regular blood vessel. With Bill Abbott at Mass General Hospital, we put them into pigs, which is the best animal model, and the blood vessels are open months later. This is by angiography. One of the questions you might ask is if you're Bill Clinton or anybody who needs this procedure, well, don't you need it right away? I mean, don't you need the blood cells right away? And the answer is, for a lot of people, you do. So how could we ever get a bank, let's say, a bank of blood vessel cells? So Shulam Levenberg, another one of our postdocs, he's now a professor at Technion, actually took, for the first time, human embryoid bodies and looked at their development. She discovered that at exactly day 15, you'd get a very high level of endothelial cell characteristics. And using certain antibodies, she was actually able to pull these out and clone them and develop the very first human embryonic endothelial cells. Put them on these polymers, and they actually form little blood vessels. Here's an example. These are markers of endothelial cells. A second example that I wanted to go over with you is cartilage. About 1 million people every year need new cartilage. And so Chuck Vacanti, one of our collaborators, actually worked on this. And the idea is that we could take the patient's own cells to do this so they shouldn't reject. And he did this on a nude mice initially. So here's the mouse. In this case, Chuck redid this guy's skull. Here he redid this guy's cheek. If you open up the animals and look at them, it's pure white glistening cartilage. And it has the other biochemical characteristics of cartilage. It is not, however, strong enough at this point for, like, you know, knee injuries and things like that. We're still studying that. Are there better reactor conditions? Are there better nutrients that we can put in to make these? Still in all, if we can do this, we could solve various cosmetic problems and other problems. One of them is Chuck actually sees patients that don't have ears, little children that don't have ears. So Linda Griffith, who was one of our postdocs at the time, now a professor at MIT, actually made scaffold in the form of a human ear. Here's a high-power SEM of it. These are the fibers, these are the cells, cartilage cells, here's the matrix. Chuck actually did not yet put this on humans. He has put it on rabbits. Here's the rabbit with the human ear. And I know sometimes people look at this and they say, why do you do this to rabbits? And the reason is because we want to do it to people. And this was actually the very first clinical trial done under a physician-sponsored IND by Jay, my colleague. And it's a 12-year-old boy. If you look at him closely, notice he has no chest covering his heart. Like other 12-year-olds, though, he likes to play baseball. And you might imagine that if he ever got hit in the chest with a baseball, he could die. So Jay actually operated on him. We fashioned him a new chest. And he's actually doing fine still today. Another example, this was not done by us. This was done by people who licensed the technology from us, was to make new skin for burn victims. Here's a little boy who's very badly burned. But you can take a product, which in this case is the polymer scaffold with neonatal skin fibroblasts, put it in the child at the time of injury. If you come back 3 weeks later, he looks like this. Come back 6 months later, he looks like this. So that you can actually use it for burns and also for skin ulcers. And the very last example I want to give you, which was work done by Aaron Levick, another of our graduate students, not a professor at Yale, is could we help in spinal cord repair? And Aaron actually made a polymer scaffold that really would mimic the gray matter and white matter of the spinal cord. She created an outer portion of the implant to help provide axonal guidance, and an inner portion where she could put neuronal stem cells. Here we collaborated very closely with Evan Snyder, who's a neuronal stem cell expert. And what we did in these experiments, and again, it was a lot of 5 years' work, but basically they did some surgery where they would take out a section of the spinal cord in rats and make the rats paraplegic. And then within 24 hours, they would add one of four things, three sets of controls, cells by themselves, polymer by itself, or sham operations. And the experiments were cell polymer scaffold combinations. And we followed the animals for a year to see what they do. And probably the most compelling thing is to look at behavioral studies. So what I thought I'd do is show you animals who are paralyzed 100 days after the experiment started and just to follow what they normally look like. And there's actually a way to quantitate these using a BBB score. What I want you to do is follow the animal's hind limbs. This will give you an idea of what's happening. His paws are splayed in a rather awkward fashion, and he's kind of dragging the feet. What we saw as we did 45 controls, or some were worse than this, some were better than this. This is just the mean, but it gives you an idea of how he's dragging his feet. There's a tiny bit of recovery after the 100 days, but not much. And this is quite typical of the controls. Now, the very last thing I'll show you this afternoon is a similar video of exactly the same kind of rat, not our best, not our worst, the mean of the experiments, also 100 days later. And in contrast to the other rat, I hope you'll see that this rat was not a cure by any means, but is able to bear his own weight. In fact, this guy is kind of heavy even. But you see, he can bear his own weight. And he's a bit clumsy, but the point is he's doing much better than these other guys. He's actually kind of fast. Look at the paws, they're splayed in a much more normal fashion. Actually, my wife tells me not to leave that on too long either. not sure how to get that off, Prasad, but at any rate, that's kind of what I wanted to tell you today. I mean, in many senses, we've raised more questions than we've answered. There's so much work, I think, that to go on in bioengineering, chemical engineering, material science, so much we don't know in terms of delivering drugs, in terms of engineering tissues, and more broadly across the board in bioengineering and the problems we face. But it is my hope that this is just the beginning of how one can use these kinds of engineering principles to try to create new entities that can relieve life, that can relieve suffering and prolong life. Thank you very, very much for having me here today. And I'm certainly happy to answer questions.
I'm sure Professor Langer would happily answer a few questions.
If there are any, I know there's food outside. Yeah, sure. Yeah. So the question is what happens to the gold And what happens is, as far as we can tell, is there's a gold chloride complex. And, of course, the amount that's there is incredibly small. And exactly what its fate is, we're not sure. We believe it gets excreted, but we haven't done detailed studies on that yet. But the amounts are incredibly low. And Jim Anderson, as I mentioned, has done a tremendous amount of pathology looking at the response, which is essentially, you know, non-existent. Even he's up the gold levels many times. But we believe it gets excreted. Yes?
You mentioned artificial heart, and you mentioned twice biocompatibility. And I think that biocompatibility is a big problem in material science in applies to medicine. What is your view about the future for artificial heart? We need a lot of them.
Yes. So my question is, what is my view about the future of the artificial heart? Well, I think that, I mean, I'm hardly an expert on the artificial heart, but I think that it's an area that I think really is an important area of research. I think it's an area where the mechanical engineers have actually done a pretty good job. You know, I think it beats long enough, but I think it does need some help in the materials area. You know, I mean, I think still the biggest issue, even the latest turn down by the FDA, even a couple months ago, had to do with strokes, just the very issue that I mentioned. And I've been saying this for a long time. So I think that figuring out some way to deal with the stroke issue is going to be the key thing right now in terms of safety, whether it's a new material or you do localized delivery of something, you know, an antithrombotic agent.
So surface activation of blood clotting is still not solved.
I would say that's correct, what you said, yes. Other questions?
Over there.
Was there a question? I'm not sure. Maybe people want food. I don't know. Are there any other questions?
If there are no other questions, let's thank Professor Langer again for this.